Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, May 26th, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So, Avi, there's a lot happening in the news. There's a memorandum of understanding between the U.S. and Iran on the conflict in the Middle East, just as U.S. forces strike against Iran. There's also a lot bubbling up in Cuba. Oh, and a suspect was shot and killed after firing at the White House over the weekend. So much to discuss. There's also the president's anti-weaponization fund, Republican pushback, and its primary day in Texas. So when there's a lot going on, we bring in the big dogs, a couple of really smart people to help us break it all down. And that's what we are going to do today. We've got Riley Began of The Washington Post and Mark Caputo of Axios lined up to help us work through all the national stories. And of course, we want to hear from you, our listeners. What national stories are you following most closely? And what do you want to know more about? You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers and YouTubers, you can put your story, suggestions, and questions or comments in the chat.
888-477-9499. Again, studio2@whyy.org. First, a trio of local news stories before we get to the national and international news. Let's start in New Jersey for story number one here. A simmering dispute over an ICE detention facility in North Jersey boiled over yesterday with federal agents firing pepper balls at protesters and also New Jersey Senator Andy Kim. So the facility in question here is called Delaney Hall. It's in Newark. It's privately owned, has about 1,000 beds. Detainees and advocates claim the conditions inside are inhumane. DHS officials dispute that characterization. On Friday, some detainees began a hunger strike, according to the New York Times. DHS, by the way, also denies that there's a hunger strike occurring. Various New Jersey officials have tried to get inside this facility, Delaney Hall. Recently, members of New Jersey's congressional delegation were allowed inside, but on Monday, Governor Mikey Sherrill was denied access to Delaney Hall. Also on Monday, roughly 125 protesters gathered outside the facility. DHS claims they were obstructing law enforcement from exiting the area. Senator Andy Kim told NJ.com he was there to try to de-escalate the situation. However, at some point yesterday, federal agents fired those pepper balls at the crowd. DHS says no one was directly hit. Andy Kim told NJ.com he breathed in some sort of irritant and that he and others received first aid on site. And there's a video corroborating at least some of that account. And so that is where things stand right now as this tension over the facility in Newark continues to escalate.
Yeah, look, I have been in the vicinity of those pepper balls on multiple occasions, just covering protests as a reporter, and they are very powerful. Even if you are not hit, you can be temporarily blinded, difficulty breathing, coughing. So I hope everybody's okay. The senator said he was hit in the hand by an unknown object. Who knows what that was? Water bottles were flying. But, you know, it raises a lot of questions, I think, about transparency. I think that's what the protesters want. I wonder why the governor wasn't allowed in. Maybe some of this would have been able to de-escalate had the governor been allowed in or more people been allowed in. But I think that, you know, things will probably continue to heat up until people figure out what's going on inside. DHS is calling this a political stunt and they're blaming New Jersey's sanctuary policies. But I think people just want answers. And you do have a First Amendment right to protest as long as you don't block roadways and things like that. So there's conflict.
Yeah, there's basic disputes over basic facts, which tells you that something needs to be resolved here.
Exactly.
Story number two.
Clarence B. Jones, the Philadelphia native who served as counsel to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and inspired a portion of his I Have a Dream speech, has died. Jones was valedictorian of Palmyra High School's class of 1949. He was 95 years old. And if you've never heard of this man, he was the lawyer and confidant to Dr. King. He was just 29 when he first met King and turned out to be a brilliant organizer. He was one of the folks that helped to put together the 1963 March on Washington. Jones was also King's speechwriter, inspiring a memorable portion of the I Have a Dream speech. Here's Jones talking about the speech during an interview I did with him back in 2017. Take a look, listen.
You're gathered here today to cash a check that has been returned, marked for insufficient funds.
I have a dream that one day...
It was his speech. I was just honored that he would incorporate the text.
And Jones was 86 when I met him. Palmyra High School actually renamed their library after him back in 2017. And I have to mention that Jones did so much during the movement. He was one of the lawyers representing King in the groundbreaking New York Times versus Sullivan case that established a rule that public officials cannot recover in defamation cases against the press unless they prove actual malice. At the time, public officials used to sue journalists and news organizations covering the civil rights movement in order to bankrupt them. And that coverage was critical to the movement. But New York Times versus Sullivan is still precedent today.
Yeah, what a life. I mean, what a life. And you've only touched on portions
of it. That was just the beginning of his life.
Absolutely. And I was reading in his obituary, he's born in Philadelphia.
Yes.
Grew up, as you mentioned, and went to Palmyra High School. But I think what happened was his parents put him into the foster system, I think at age six, because they could no longer care for him. And I just was thinking about the decision his parents made to set him on the path to this incredible life, how painful that must have been. But truly just an incredible, just breathtakingly vast life that this man lived.
Oh yeah. And if you look it up, and I say read about him, because he was the unseen hand in so many key civil rights events. And when I tell you, when I met him, he did not look his age. He looked like he was in his 60s, despite the fact that he was mid-80s. And I was so impressed by him. He was so charismatic. And he said his secret to looking so young was champagne.
Good secret.
Hey.
Good to know. yeah, and it also just a reminder, right, that you know, these speeches and these movements, mm-hmm. there's often sort of like... a face, and there's all those people working behind the scenes to make it all possible. And even something like a speech, you know, it feels like an individual accomplishment. It's a group project in many ways as well. And so it's just a good reminder of you always focus on the people, but change is not one person, right?
Yeah,
it's
rest a lot in of people. Peace, Clarence B. Jones.
Finally, our third story.
Yes.
On this Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
An advertising tactic employed by a local businessman is raising the question for many. Where does marketing stop and cruelty begin?
I like that question.
So here's the story. A guy who calls himself Smoothie Man Mike has been going around Philadelphia leaving fake parking tickets on car windshields.
You're wrong.
The tickets are actually coupons for his plant-based smoothie business. And I got to say, the Smoothie Man did a pretty good job on these replicas. They do look like PPA parking tickets, Jerry. They do.
They make me mad, but go ahead.
there's actually a section for potential violations on it, which include driving around dehydrated and lack of fruits and veggies. Obviously, if you look even semi-closely at them, you realize they're not actual parking tickets. We first saw this on Philly Reddit, where there was a vigorous debate over whether this is a genius way to get attention or a very cruel joke.
And you know, I didn't think it was real. Especially because he had a New Jersey area code on his phone.
You
number.
Doubted the veracity of this whole story. Our producer, Paige, reached out to Smoothie Man Mike and obtained a statement from him. He tells us, quote, "Yeah, it's real," laughing emoji. "I made them as a creative promo for my smoothie business. I wanted to do something Philly inspired that would actually grab attention and make people laugh once they realized it wasn't a real ticket. You know, trying different marketing." So what do we think here? Are we saluting or slamming the Smoothie Man for this marketing tactic?
Well, Avi, Wolfman, Aaron, it definitely got attention.
But is it
good attention, though? Because people hate tickets and they really don't like PPA. So are you going to transfer that hate and dislike to Smoothie Man Mike? I don't know. Some people did. In the Reddit comments, it was mixed.
I'm saluting the Smoothie Man. He got attention. This guy's out here hustling, trying to start a smoothie business.
He did get attention.
It's very hard in this day and age to break through. And the Smoothie Man is breaking through. And look, you're going to you figure out within like 3 seconds it's not an actual ticket.
But it's like trash on your windshield, though.
But you're getting those anyways. People are already putting the flyers on your windshield. He's not the reason for that.
I like smoothies, but I hate tickets. I have mixed emotions.
We're talking about smoothies today. That's the bottom line. We are talking about the Smoothie Man. I'm saluting the Smoothie Man. Also, Smoothie by the way, Man great Mike. Name. Great name, Smoothie Man. Smoothie Man Mike. I'm going to call myself News Guy Avi.
And why does he have a Jersey area call? I'm like, you know, that. It just, and this is a very Philly thing to do, though.
That's the cell phone era. That's people true. Have that's all sorts true. Of area codes. I put that aside.
But it was a very Philly thing to do, though.
Plant-based smoothies.
Yeah.
Apparently based in Brewery Town. The Smoothie Man.
But, you know, I'll remember Smoothie Man Mike for, you know, at least today.
At least today. Mm-hmm. We have poor memories. Maybe by tomorrow, I'm not sure we'll be able to. Anyways, we remember what we're talking about today on the show.
Yeah. National news stories.
There it is.
A couple of really smart people. We'll be right back. This is Studio 2. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. President Donald Trump announced over the weekend that a peace deal with Iran was nearly finalized. But just as Iranian officials landed in Qatar for negotiations, U.S. forces carried out new strikes. Meanwhile, tensions with Cuba are rising after the DOJ indicted former President Raul Castro.
Today, we're looking at all the latest national and international headlines. Are we any closer to ending the war in Iran? Are we nearing a major conflict with Cuba? Plus, as Trump pushes for extravagant White House renovations and a nearly $2 billion anti-weaponization fund, are Republicans breaking with Trump? And as midterm primaries pick up speed, what does the future of the party look like for Democrats?
Yes, and with us to unpack it all are two fantastic political reporters. We have Riley Beggin, Congressional Economic Policy Correspondent at The Washington Post. Riley, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you.
We also have Mark Caputo, Senior Politics Reporter covering the White House for Axios. Mark, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And for you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere, what national story are you following most closely, and what do you want to know more about? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTube streamers, you can comment in the live chat.
So let's get folks up to speed, Mark, on the latest with the negotiations between the U.S. and Iran. So when people hear over the weekend that it seems like some sort of deal is close or maybe even imminent, and then they read headlines about strikes, they're likely to be quite confused. Are we back to square one here? Are negotiations ongoing and moving forward? What do we know about the status of those negotiations?
I would say both is that we're probably back at square one and negotiations are happening. But the problem with the talks is that essentially you need a two-track way to get out of this. One mm-hmm. is the proximate problem is the Strait of Hormuz from the United States position, and Iran sees the Strait of Hormuz closure as its primary leverage weapon. So the United States has erected a blockade. So common sense dictates we lift the blockade, the United States does, Iran lift its stranglehold on the Strait of Hormuz. The problem is that the president of the United States wants a nuclear component in stage one of any talks. The problem with that from the Iranian point of view is they want compensation of some form or fashion, namely, or at least immediately in the unfreezing of assets. But the United States president doesn't want to do that. So you can't really get to stage two when one side wants stage two and stage one, and then the other side wants part of stage two answered in stage one anyway, and that the other side doesn't want. It just becomes sort of this Ouroboros, this sort of snake that feeds on itself.
But do these latest strikes and counter strikes, do they mean that anything has gotten worse with the negotiations? Or are they kind of happening in a sort of a separate arena from the negotiations themselves?
Well, I don't really know. You can't really. The problem that you have with Iran is something called the Mosaic Doctrine. They've essentially broken their military in about 33 parts.
Yeah.
And so you have different arms that are doing different things. And we need to be clear here is the United States was negotiating with the Iranians in good faith in this respect. And the Iranians decided, according to the United States, to send out vessels to start mining the Strait of Hormuz. So if you're negotiating on the opening of the Strait of Hormuz, and you're then mining it, it doesn't look like you're operating in good faith. So yeah, then you have the tit for tat that happened. But this could just be posturing and using men's lives and materiel in the balance. But nevertheless, it's a good sign when people are talking and a bad sign when people are shooting, and both signs are happening. Mm.
Yeah. George says on Facebook, the Iran deal still ain't a done deal, mostly because the Indeed. Iranians have little faith that the U.S. will actually abide by any, quote, deal we sign. And so, you know, Mark, I wanted to sort of bring in another aspect of what's happening in the Middle East. And Trump says he wants more countries to join the Abraham Accords, even Iran eventually. Can you talk about what's happening with that, what these accords are, and why this is becoming an issue now?
Well, the accords essentially are an effort from Trump's first term to get the United States, or better said, that it's led by the United States, to have Israel recognized by Middle Eastern leaders, mainly Arab states, but, you know, obviously Iran is a Persian state. So by Muslim states in the region who are hostile to it. And it's a signature move by President Trump. And yeah, sure, he'd like everyone to join it. But, you know, I mean, I'd like a Maserati. Just because you would like it doesn't mean it's going to happen. And the fundamental problem that you have in respect to the tension you have with the Abraham Accords is they were designed to essentially bypass, and I'm just going to put this in air quotes, the Palestinian issue, right? Like, let's leave that aside and let's do other things. And October of 2023, October 7th, is when Hamas strikes Israel in the conflict that then touches off the Gaza war. And it becomes sort of impossible for Muslim nations to therefore ignore. And to be very clear, Hamas did that pretty clearly, according to U.S. intelligence and all open source information, with the backing and support of Iran. And when the new Trump administration came back in, they said, okay, the only way to get a peace deal or to have hostilities really stop in Gaza is to also deal with Iran. And so here we are back at square one.
Yeah. But why would Trump be pushing for this expansion of the Abraham Accords at the same time as negotiating with Iran over the Strait of Hormuz?
Because he wants to win. Donald Trump wants to do things. And the default for Donald Trump is generally action, if he can do things that make a difference. And this extends to anything. Yeah. And it's the through line with Donald Trump, right? Gilding the White House, that's action. Painting the reflecting pool, that's action. Tariffs, redoing tariffs, that's action. He wants to do things and make a difference. I'm not saying it's a great strategy or technique or tactic or whatever, but that is sort of the explanation. Like, he wants motion, he wants results. The problem he's got in the Strait of Hormuz, in Iran and in the Middle East, is that we're in sort of this stasis where, you know, some of this movement becomes very complicated.
Yeah, Riley, want to bring you into the conversation. What's the reaction at home among Republicans and Democrats as, you know, Mark talks about President Trump is kind of, you know, jumping from issue to issue, just trying to get something done, trying to get a win, because he knows that Iran right now is an L, a loss.
Yeah, this will probably be the through line for our entire conversation, but there's a lot of frustration among congressional Republicans about the way that the president is focusing on the things that he wants to focus on going through the rest of the year, rather than the things that would be most helpful for Republicans who are in a real battle to keep control of both chambers of Congress. The war is immensely unpopular. The downstream effects of it, the gas prices are having a big impact on voters. And there are a lot of Republicans who are frustrated with this. The number that are willing to speak out publicly, though, of course, is smaller.
It was interesting, however, when news of this potential deal surfaced, there was a senator from Mississippi, Roger Wicker, who, like, for most Americans would not be like a senator they could name or identify, came out and spoke against. Again, we didn't know exactly what the deal was, but the contours of the deal, which suggests that there, you know, we focus a lot, I think, on the sort of the isolationist wing that's emerging within the Republican Party. But there's still a big block of Republicans who are very hawkish on Iran and the Middle East and must be pushing the president from the other side. I mean, do you have a sense, Riley, of which camp is stronger right now, or which one has the president's ear more as they try to unwind this situation in Iran?
I mean, I think Mark would tell you this, too, that in the end, it's what the president wants to do. He isn't really listening to members of Congress that closely. Yeah. But you're right. There is a really strong hawkish wing of the Republican Party that, you know, wants to see the president pursue war in Iran and thinks it's really important to, you know, strip nuclear capabilities in the region. So You're right. There's definitely a big contingency that wants to see it happen. And, you know, when it's helpful for the president to play on that support, I think he will.
Yeah. And speaking of, you know, the hawkish wing, got to switch a little bit and talk about Cuba, because the administration unveiled criminal charges against Raul Castro while warning about Cuban ties to Russia, China and Iran. Mark, would love for you to just sort of lay out what's happening in Cuba. And could this, is this an escalation? What could be coming next here?
Well, what's likely coming next is, while everyone's all worked up about this idea of an invasion, and I'm not saying an invasion is an impossibility or military action is an impossibility. You wouldn't want to say that with Donald Trump. The army that he's really dispatching here is an army of Treasury bureaucrats to deploy weapons of mass economic destruction on an already shattered Cuban economy and to try to bring the regime to its knees. In the process, obviously, it increases the suffering on the Cuban people. So while the indictment of Raul Castro is certainly a rung on the escalation ladder, it's not the real story. The real story is what happened on May 1st. Now, May 1st is a very significant day that communists worldwide like to celebrate. It's May Day, right? Workers' Day. And on that very day, President Trump, at the urging of Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, who's from Miami, a Miami Cuban American member in good standing, favorite son of the exile community here from Cuba, they made sure to issue these regulations on May 1st that slap heretofore unlevied sanctions, what are called secondary sanctions, on companies, foreign companies mainly, or any company, that does business with Cuba's military-industrial complex, its giant company or corporation essentially called GAESA. It's an acronym. And so the real juice that is sort of being squeezed from Cuba is there in the sanctions realm. And it's helpful to remember Cuba's now essentially being recolonized by the United States by these successive sanctions, the Cuban embargo, to the degree that they're different from these sanctions, which they are. I can get into it if you want. And the United States now essentially controls the food. U.S. companies control almost all the food that goes to Cuba. The United States essentially controls the oil that goes to Cuba, or the lack thereof. Cuba is desperate for hard dollars. Basically, its economy runs on hard dollars that are essentially sort of imported in there. Almost all its auto parts, anything, household supplies, that comes from the United States.
Yeah.
And so this is just a tremendous pressure campaign. Parts of Havana only have 2 hours of electricity a day. Mm-hmm. Other parts of Cuba are completely black. And I live in Miami. That's where I'm broadcasting from, or whatever we call it now. And, you know, June 1st is coming up. June 1st is for us in South Florida, or us in the Caribbean, technically not the Caribbean, right? For us who live along the Strait of Florida, this is essentially the start of summer, June 1st. It's a sort of hurricane season. And so you're going to have people just broiling in the heat with no to very little electricity, certainly no air conditioning and barely any fans, very little refrigeration. Food can start to spoil, and it becomes a very desperate situation. And there you could see a conflict start to arise if people take to the streets. And then the question is, what does the Cuban regime do to them? Do they brutally repress them the way they did in 2021 and 2022? Or if they do, does Donald Trump then react with military force? Sorry, long answer.
Yeah, and I guess my quick response to that, Mark, is, you know, this is a Cuban people who have been conditioned to take a lot of pain, you know,
There's
through this regime.
Pain.
And so, you know, as far as like, what is there any indication of what the ultimate goal here
it's in federal law.
Yeah.
I mean, in 1996 with the Brothers of the Rescue shoot down, which is what Raul Castro was indicted for. They shot down two planes with four aid workers, or as they call themselves. The United States passed something called the Helms-Burton Act, and it codifies the U.S. embargo. And it says the United States will lift the embargo against Cuba, essentially around three things. There's a fourth, but we can get into that later. Free political prisoners, free elections, and the right to freely associate. That's what Cuba has to do, and Cuba will not do it.
Mm. I want to read this comment from Matt talking about a conversation we had earlier. Matt says, I am shocked that anyone finds the Iranian regime trustworthy. They made plain from the hostage crisis in 79 and onward, they only respond to force. Holding the Strait hostage is right out of their standard playbook. Negotiation on their part is just about delay. We're asking you this hour, what national/international story are you following most closely? What do you want to know more about? The phone number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, comment in the live chat. Before I move on from Cuba, you know, Mark, you laid out earlier as an explanation for what Trump does, the sort of the do something doctrine. Is that basically what's at play here with Cuba as well? Or is there anything?
Well, this is unfinished business. Sorry to cut you off.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things the New York Post came up with a catchy title, the Don Roe Doctrine, right? The Monroe Doctrine. Monroe Doctrine basically was invented because of Cuba, like way back in the 1830s or whatever it was. And so this is unfinished business from the beginning of the Cuban Revolution in 1959. Marco Rubio just plays such an outsized role here, again, as the favorite son of the Cuban exile community, whose entire political career and his political identity has been built around this day.
And they really think through this economic pressure campaign, they can cause a regime change. They really believe that inside the White House, or they hope that, or they have a plan for that?
I think it's somewhere in between, right? They hope for that. But if a situation arises where the United States feels compelled to send in the military, I would not rule that out, and nor will they.
Mm. Yeah. And so I want to shift now, Riley, to another story. You know, there was a shooting near the White House. A man who took shots at the White House is now dead. Could you tell us what happened over the weekend? Because there have been multiple armed incidents near top federal officials in just a month.
Yeah, this was a 21-year-old man from Maryland who actually had been charged with trespassing at the White House before. On Saturday, opened fire at a security checkpoint and Secret Service agents returned fire. He was killed in that exchange. I believe another bystander was also injured. But you're right. Yeah, this is the third attempted shooting in the last month. There was an incident near the Washington Monument in April. And then, of course, the White House Correspondents' Dinner earlier that month. So, you know, there have been a number of these incidents. I think it's certainly concerning. And I think, as we'll talk about more, it's also really fueled the White House interest in building this ballroom, which they have argued is related to security.
Are there any major unanswered questions about this latest incident, Riley? Or is it seems like we sort of have the information we're going to have at this point? Because you mentioned the man, it seems like his motives were convoluted at best. Are we still waiting for more here? Is there a formal update coming? Or has the dust seemingly settled on this latest really scary incident near the White House?
You know, Mark may be able to speak more to the details of what happens next here, but what I can say is that this seems to be like a lone actor. Mm-hmm. He clearly had mental health issues, believed that he was Jesus. I don't think that he left a manifesto. So it's definitely different than the shooting that happened at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. But in terms of additional questions, I actually don't know.
Yeah. Mark, do you have anything to add to this?
No, I mean, the reality is we got a lot of crazy people who have access to firearms. And, you know, when the two come together, it's not a pretty sight.
Yeah. And so, Riley, one of the things you mentioned is that, you know, the president immediately is tying this to the ballroom that is being built right now. It's huge. It's expensive. And he says that it will solve a lot of the problems around security. Tell us what's the status and what has been the reaction to this big building that's being built on the White House property.
Yeah, proposed 90,000 square foot ballroom and the East Wing of the White House. As you guys probably know, the East Wing has been torn down, so it's sort of an open construction site. The president was there with reporters last week, showing off the progress, so to speak, that's been made so far. But it's kind of in flux right now. This has been challenged in court. Construction has theoretically been paused by the courts, but there has been a continuation in recent days. So that's a little bit up in the air. But it's in the middle of a court challenge. And, you know, what the White House has been pushing Congress really hard on is this proposed $1 billion for security related to the East Wing Modernization Project. That's the sort of formal title for this project in the Republican Reconciliation Bill, which is ostensibly intended to appropriate $72 billion towards immigration and customs enforcement and customs and border protection. I can talk more about the details of request.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because then that triggered this review by the Senate parliamentarian, and that created a new quagmire. So walk us through the steps of that. Like, there was this $1 billion for the East Wing Modernization Project. It's part of this larger package that's mostly around immigration enforcement. And then what happens?
Yeah. So the Senate parliamentarian, this is wonky, reviews the reconciliation.
You're on public radio, Riley. Don't worry about
wonk
it.
Wonk is what we do best. Go right ahead.
Wonderful. This is a part of any reconciliation package. The Senate parliamentarian wants to make sure that it complies with the really complicated rules governing reconciliation. It's called the Byrd Rule that has all of these things that they need to meet. So the $1 billion was a part of that review, as was the other $72 billion for immigration. And the parliamentarian determined that the ballroom money, because it is crosses a bunch of different committees, would have to essentially be rewritten. So it was the way it was written couldn't be included in the bill. But at the time, I think it was at this point 2 weekends ago, Senate Republicans pledged that they were going to try to figure out how to get it in there. That would involve rewriting the legislation in some way. Over the course of the week, that really fell apart. Is connected to another big Trump project. But at the moment, it seems like that is not going to be included in the reconciliation bill.
Can I ask you, because we're talking about lots of things, and for some reason, we're doing a lot of sort of armchair analysis of Donald Trump this hour, which I wasn't anticipating. But this one is so strange to me because it feels totally divorced from politics. Like, you could, there is a political explanation for Iran, for Cuba. We're going to talk about the weaponization fund. There's some sort of political undercurrent. This ballroom stuff, I can only conceive of it as coming from the mind of Donald Trump. And I don't know of anyone else who's asking for it unless they've been prompted by Donald Trump to, you know, to ask for it. Can you explain coherently why this has become such an urgent issue for the White House?
Yeah, you're right that there is no large contingency in Congress clamoring for the building of this ballroom. You know, to do my own armchair analysis, I suppose, I think this is a part of him building his legacy. He wants to leave his mark in Washington. You know, he has redone the Rose Garden. He's obviously interested in sort of glamorizing the White House in his image. You know, there is, of course, a big portion of the White House that has argued that this is necessary for security reasons. A few days ago, the president said, I think that there was a six-story section underground. The White House did not confirm that size, but certainly theoretically a large underground security apparatus. And some of this money, the Secret Services argue, would go to securing that portion.
I have a quick follow up that relates to this, Riley, because people are just tuning into this argument, what we heard in the beginning was that this will be paid for by private money. And now you have Congress sort of stepping in to put billions of dollars forward. And for folks who don't necessarily follow this all the time, they're probably wondering how in the world did this shift?
I mean, I think what's even more important to the White House than the money here is the theoretical legal authorization for the ballroom. Court case that has held up the advancement of this project argues that Congress needs to approve it. And the White House has said if this money gets in this bill, that is the equivalent of Congress approving the project. Of course, money is also nice. And the attempted shooting in April at the White House Correspondents' Dinner really sparked this push from the administration. And they are saying that the project itself, the $400 million estimate, will still be funded by private donors, but that this congressional money would go towards the security side of things.
Mm-hmm. Well, coming up on the other side of this break, which we're coming up on very quickly, we're going to talk about that other large pot of money that Riley referred to. It's $1.8 billion for an anti-weaponization fund. We're also going to talk about some Republican backlash to Trump recently. We're talking with Mark Caputo and Riley Beggin. We're hearing from you this hour. This is Studio 2 on WHYY. Don't go anywhere.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. And this hour, we're covering the biggest political headlines at home and abroad, including growing rifts in the GOP around President Trump's White House renovations and anti-weaponization fund. There's also a consequential primary runoff in Texas today. Trump-endorsed candidate Attorney General Ken Paxton challenging incumbent John Cornyn. That winner will face the Democratic candidate James Tallarico in the fall.
Yes, and let me reintroduce our guests. We have Riley Beggin, congressional economic policy correspondent at the Washington Post, and Mark Caputo, senior politics reporter covering the White House for Axios.
What national story are you following? We want to know. What do you want to know more about? 888-477-9499 is the number. The email is studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the live chat.
And Avi teased this on the, you know, before the break, Trump's proposed $1.8 billion anti-weaponization payout fund. I wanted to bring you into the conversation, Riley, if you could just explain to us what this fund is in plain English and who could have access to it.
So this is the result of a lawsuit filed by President Trump against the IRS over the 2019 leak of his confidential tax records. Now, in this year, his administration agreed to settle the case for, as you mentioned, 1.8, rounding down. It's $1.776 billion.
Symbolic,
yeah,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, symbolic for people targeted by what they've described as a weaponized justice system. There are a lot of details that are still missing from how this fund will work. But Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche says that people of any political persuasion can apply for this. But the examples that they use in their filings are all under Democratic administrations. And of course, there is a lot of concern from members of Congress that this money could go towards people who were convicted of violent crimes on January 6, 2021.
So Margaret asked the question I think that many are asking, and I'll direct this to you, Mark. Could your guests explain why the Trump settlement slush fund seems to be the last straw in corruption, self-dealing, and lawlessness for some Republicans who have bowed to him in all other ways? Now, some would dispute Margaret's characterization, but this does seem to have become a sticking point. There's now a delayed vote because of this, perhaps because of this anti-weaponization fund. And there's vocal pushback. You know, maybe Mitch McConnell's on his way out of Washington, but he had a pretty searing quote calling this fund utterly stupid, morally wrong. Okay, so Mark, what's going on here? Answer Margaret's question. Why does this seem to be a sticking point, or is it maybe not the sticking point it appears to be?
I would say, to use another cliche, it's a straw that, well, you can't say broke the camel's back, but really debilitated the camel. If you just sort of stack everything on top of it, so you have the weaponization fund, the 1776 fund, or whatever you want to call it, the ballroom, the war, and then the fact that Trump got rid of Cassidy. I mean, he's not gone yet, but
this is the senator from Louisiana who lost his primary. Yeah,
correct. And then just right before this happened, or around the time that happened, he decides to endorse against Texas Senator John Cornyn. So enough senators are just like, look, I just can't eat this. It's just one thing too many.
Can we focus on that last part, the endorsement against Cornyn? Mm-hmm. That seems to have really struck a chord with members of the caucus. I want you to explain why, because looking from the outside, some people might analyze that and say, you allow Trump to do whatever he wants, but when he comes for your power, for your position, that's when you stand up. Is that really the dynamic here, or is there something else?
Welcome to the United States Senate. I mean, remember, the United States Senate wants to protect the United States Senate. So one of the big sticking points in all of this is the Senate's arcane rules. Riley earlier had the misfortune of having to talk about the bird rule. And she didn't actually use the phrase bird bath, but yes, that exists. And like, suddenly you can't have a majority vote. And for a guy like Donald Trump, who is, you know, was not raised a politician, like, this stuff is just utter BS. He figures if you have majorities in Congress in your party, you should do what the party wants to do. But instead, there are all these rules. So Trump is just sick of the United States Senate and its rules. And the United States Senate is sick of Donald Trump.
Yeah. And so, you know, you think about the midterms. This is a primary day in Texas. You think about Trump's approval ratings, which are 37%, I think, of people approve.
Well, that's nationwide. That's
nationwide.
Nationwide.
And you think about as Republicans start to panic as they head into the midterm, because what works in a primary may not work in November. And so, you know, what kind of quandary are Republicans being left with, Riley, as we think about going forward? Because the president has been on this revenge campaign all across the country, taking out anybody who has opposed him or voted against him. And this could hurt them in just a few months, Riley.
That's the frustration. It's, you know, there is frustration in protection of John Cornyn as someone who has been in the Senate since, I think, 2003 or around there. He was basically the runner up to John Thune. There's a lot of respect for him among the Senate Republicans. But beyond that, it's also a self-interest issue. This, you know, there is a lot of money that is going to have to go to defend Ken Paxton as the Republican nominee if he wins that wouldn't have to be used if it was John Cornyn. So that money is going to pull away from people like Susan Collins in Maine or other really competitive Senate races.
And just to explain that a little further, Riley, for folks who might not follow, what you're saying, I think, is that because Paxton and Tallarico seems like it could be a close race, and Texas is a very expensive state to run campaigns in, that could pull national money away from some other vulnerable senators. That's the kind of dynamic that people are worried about in Washington. Am I right?
Exactly. It's just spreading the money too thin when it maybe didn't have to be that way.
I want to read this email from Matt, who says maybe the best news is that both parties are getting fragmented. Mm-hmm. Each has moved so far into their respective ideological corners. They have alienated a large portion of the public. Can there be a correction to the sane middle? Let's talk about the Democrats now, Riley. So let's talk about this long, I guess you would say, suppressed DNC autopsy about what happened in 2024. It was finally released last week. What was in the report and what was the reaction to it?
This has been definitely messy. What was in the report
of the day?
Exactly. You know, there was a lot of analysis about the relationship between, you know, Biden and Harris. They argued that the Biden administration didn't elevate Harris enough and prepare her for the spotlight. You know, there was a emphasis on wanting to appeal better to rural and southern voters. A lot of discussion of campaign and ad strategy. There was a ad from the Trump campaign that was particularly effective against Vice President Kamala Harris that related to supporting surgery for transgender prisoners. So all of that was a part of it. But I think what is equally interesting is what was missing. There was very little discussion, for example, of the conflict over Gaza and Israel that really tore apart the party in 2024. There was very little discussion of President Biden's age, which was a big concern to voters. And there notably was no conclusion, real forward.
And that's Brian says the Democrats need to focus on what they are doing, going to do to improve the country, not just criticizing the Republicans. Everyone can see what the Republicans are doing and not doing. The Democrats need to outline what they are going to do if elected, not just do what the people don't currently like. And so that's the confusion that a lot of people are seeing coming out of the Democratic Party. And so Progressive has said, you know, Democrats need economic populism. Moderates say people want solutions. So, I wonder, Mark, what are we seeing bubbling up, if anything, as potential solutions as Democrats try to create some kind of strategy to make sure that they do get a blue wave in November?
Well, I can't answer what their strategy is, but the reality is there are just these almost laws of physics in politics.
Yeah.
And one of them is that a president's party, if it's in the majority in the House, loses the majority during his midterm. And once again, Donald Trump faces that as a likelihood. It happened to Joe Biden before him. It happened to Donald Trump before Joe Biden, and on and on and on and on. So the degree to which Democrats have to come up with sort of strategy and messaging, they kind of get a mulligan here just simply because of political gravity. There's a broader question about what happens in the U.S. Senate. Like, is this a year where the Democrats could actually wind up flipping the Senate? It's a narrow one. I think it's a
53 seats.
Yeah. That Republicans have. So like North Carolina, Democrats think, and Republicans don't necessarily disagree in private moments, North Carolina looks lost. So that brings the Republicans down to 52. Then there's a question of what happens in Ohio and what happens in Maine. Until, as I said on social media, a Democrat wins Texas, I'm not going to believe a Democrat's going to win Texas. So I wouldn't
gotta see it to believe it. Yeah.
Well, the other thing is Tallarico is Democrat's nominee in the Texas Senate race, and he has, at least from our common understanding of how the Texas electorate performs, a lot of baggage that dates back to what people call the woke era of Democrats, you know, mm-hmm. apologizing for his white privilege and then talking about, like, we're eating too much meat, how he loves trans kids and things like that, that don't translate well into general election politics in Texas. So we'll see. But nevertheless, Democrats are definitely on offense now. Ken Martin, the DNC chair, had totally botched this autopsy. He hired at least an acquaintance of his who certainly proved himself to be an incompetent. And then when the report, because it wasn't an autopsy, like you don't have an autopsy when the medical examiner can't determine the cause and manner of death.
He then
tried to suppress it, which made it even worse.
Yeah.
But the reality is Ken Martin has done a very good job in the Democratic Party of empowering state party chairs who say, okay, look, yeah, sure, Ken screwed up, but, you know, we're going to keep him. There are others who don't want to keep him. So they're going to have that low grade problem there. But generally speaking, the anti-Trump messaging and anti-Trump sentiment, the toll of inflation, the problems with the Iran war are more than likely going to carry Democrats across the finish line. And what does that mean? Well, that means, like the Republicans before them, when they win, they don't really learn a lot of lessons. And hell, when they lose, they don't learn a lot of lessons.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about DNC Chair Ken Martin, Riley, because there was chatter after the release of this report that maybe his job would be in peril. I guess it's sort of a two-pronged question. Like, do you really believe that? And does it really matter? Does the DNC chair still matter in this day and age of politics, other than the symbolic significance of that person losing their job potentially? Like, do you see this as consequential?
Candidly, I don't know enough about the internal workings of the DNC to know whether Ken Martin is on his way out. But I think Mark really hit on this. The question is not, you know, how Democrats are going to fare in the midterms. It's more, how are they setting the groundwork for 2028?
Yeah.
There are a lot of hurt feelings in the Democratic Party. There are progressives who feel like they haven't had a fair shake in several cycles. There could be a benefit to a change in leadership, but I think there's probably going to need to be some sort of deeper conversation before 2028 if you don't want to see a huge blow up between these sides going into the election year.
Yeah, and I'm hoping to wedge one more story in before we close out the show. We have 2 minutes left. Pope Leo came out over the weekend. He has warned that artificial intelligence could create material progress and anthropological regression, basically a world where technology advances but humanity deteriorates. I wanted to just give your thoughts. How big of an issue could AI be a wedge issue when you have the pontiff sort of speaking out on this? Could this become a wedge issue in the midterms even?
I think something that, yes, the short answer is yes, it definitely could become a midterm issue. AI is dividing people across the political spectrum, not only in the impact it's going to have in jobs and in their daily life, but also energy, water, the noise that data centers bring to communities. And candidates are kind of struggling to figure out what the line is to walk, especially when AI is actually spending a lot of money in campaigns at the same time.
Mm. Real quick, Mark, your thoughts on this or any other stories you're tracking? We have about a minute left. What's on your mind?
Within Republican circles, there's a lot of concern about AI and specifically the fact that it does not poll well. There's a huge job threat, especially of the more educated classes, right? A lot of white collar jobs could face elimination, and a lot of those people vote. And the White House's policy, at least so far, has just basically been very laissez-faire. And so this does present more of a beneficial potential cudgel to Democrats to wield against Republicans. But, you know, there's... everyone has a plan and then they get punched in the mouth.
Yeah.
As Mike Tyson famously said. So we'll see what happens.
And we'll note here that Trump seemed ready to release an executive order on AI, but also then backed away sort of at the 11th hour. And there was some intervention reportedly by venture capitalist David Sachs that might have caused that development. So just a closing note. And let me thank our guests, Mark Caputo, senior politics reporter covering the White House for Axios. Mark, really nice to talk with you this hour on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And same to you, Riley Beggin, Congressional Economic Policy Correspondent at The Washington Post. Thanks for the insights, Riley.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, and thank you to everybody who wrote in today. We appreciate your comments. And, of course, we couldn't do the show without our producers. So got to thank them, Debbie Bilder, Hazel May Bryan, and Paige Murray Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. We'll talk to you tomorrow.